It's Sunday morning. Time for the Great Outdoors with Charlie Potter. Brought to you by the all-new Chevy Silverado and ChevyDriveChicago.com on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome to the Great Outdoors Show. Charlie Potter, your host here on WGN Radio, and I'm doing the show on location, as I sometimes like to say, as I am in the Redwoods of California. To be precise, the Mirror Woods, north of San Francisco. And what a place. And for those of you listening across America who've been to the John Muir Woods, you'll know what I'm talking about. And for those of you who haven't, let me take you on a little journey this morning of something I did this week, which is truly, truly remarkable. I had the pleasure of going to San Francisco, and I say pleasure because it was the launch of the long-anticipated IMAX film, Running Wild, Return to the River. It was opened in San Francisco on Wednesday evening to the largest screen of an IMAX theater in America, over 100 feet wide, an incredibly big screen to a theater filled with 600 people. And the story of Pacific Salmon is being told on the giant screen for the first time. So from there, I went to the historic Muir Woods and to see the redwoods. And for those of you who've never seen redwood trees, you need to do it. I can simply tell you it is one of those moments in nature, in the natural world, where you just can't believe the size of these trees and how any have remained, but the sheer size and straightness of them. They were the number one tree sought after in the entire lumber industry. Much of America's West was built with railroads. Virtually all the masts that were on schooners and ships were built from redwoods, railroad ties. But today, the Muir Woods is one of the last places where the redwood is protected, and it's incredible. So I went on a long hike into the heart of the redwood forest, just north of San Francisco. Hard to believe, but you can go across the Golden Gate Bridge, and within less than half an hour of being in downtown San Francisco at the Marina District, you are in the heart of the Muir Forest and the redwoods. And a 9-mile hike takes you through the lowlands and up onto the meadows on top. And you're in a period of an absolute climate change where the Pacific fog, which of course is June in San Francisco, and Mark Twain's favorite saying, maybe not his favorite saying, but perhaps his most well-known saying, "The coldest winter I ever spent was a summer in San Francisco," came to mind. The fog is barreling in off the Pacific. It is in the mid-50s, and it's essentially raining. And yet a few hundred yards away, the sun is out, and the sky above you is blue. And you walk through this trail of terrain to get to the forest. And it's a series of, I'm in the fog and rain and I can't see anything. And then I come out on a plateau and I'm looking down to the Pacific and the fog moves through and you can't see. And then all of a sudden you get a glimpse and below you is Stinson Beach 5 miles away. And then the fog rolls back in and you continue your hike and you're headed for these mountainous trees that are what is left of the entire California coast of the tallest trees perhaps in the world, and certainly the trees for whose timber is the most sought after. So when you get into this stand, and they have the Cathedral Grove in Muir Woods, which is an area where it's supposed to be completely quiet. And on the day I was there, partially because of the weather, but also because it was a weekday, late afternoon, there were not great crowds. Today, you have to make a reservation to go to Muir Woods in advance to park your car. There's limited parking. You can't just drive up and say, "It's a beautiful day. I'd like to go to the Muir Woods." No, far too many people want to do that. So you come into this cathedral of redwood canyons, and it is... these trees are 1,000 years old, and they reach 250 feet or more straight up into the sky, and they don't have a single twist to them. You couldn't draw with a ruler a line any straighter than the spine of these redwoods reaching up into the sky. And 150 years ago was the last major fire to come through that area of what today is the Muir Woods. And so the trunks of trees are scarred from the fire of 150 years ago. That was the last major fire, and there have been fires of over hundreds of years before that. So the oldest trees, some approaching 1,000 years old, are hollowed out in their trunk where the fires, when they were much younger, burned them. And yet these trees have been able to grow and spread new roots. And you can actually, in some cases, you can stand inside of these trees. And obviously, Yosemite National Forest, further north up the California coast, is famous for its redwoods, Muir Woods, the closest to San Francisco. But the entire complex of Northern California, where the redwoods has been saved, is just spellbinding to stand in these trees and look up. And we spend most of our time in life, it seems like, looking down. When you're walking, you seldom look up at the sky because you don't want to trip. When you stand in the redwoods of Northern California, you look up. And you, in fact, in my case and other people's cases, you want to be holding on to something or leaning, because if you look up long enough, you're going to get dizzy and want to fall backwards. And all of this, this protection of the Muir Woods, was almost not possible, because in the early 1900s, after much of Northern California's redwoods had been cut, there was a plan to put a large reservoir in what is today Muir Woods, which would have flooded the redwoods that were left. And also, there was no Golden Gate Bridge then, so you couldn't get across to the Muir Woods. But people realized its potential for development, and it was going to be divided up into many parcels. And an individual, and listen to this sum of money, in 1905, an individual by the name of William Kent purchased 295 acres at the core of Muir Woods, which is today is the cathedral area of Muir Woods, for $45,000. That was a lot of money back in 1905, but nothing compared to likely the hundreds of millions of dollars, if it could be commercially sold today, that this Muir Woods would bring. And he gave it to the U.S. government. And in 1905, and Teddy Roosevelt in 1908 dedicated the Muir Woods as a national recreation area, and it became part ultimately of the Golden Gate National Recreation Area. So you think about these conservation measures that were taking place over 100 years ago, 125 years ago, to save the last vestiges, in this case of California, of this incredible resource. And today, millions of people are able to see the giant redwoods as a result of a few far-sighted people in the early 1900s who stopped this area from being put into a big water reservoir, which would have provided water for San Francisco, and also ultimately housing developments. But to go to the Muir Woods is truly one of those experiences that if you love the outdoors and you're ever in the San Francisco area, you need to do. And sitting here in the Midwest, Illinois is the prairie state. We had a few oak groves that were part of our prairies when settlement was here, but we didn't have giant trees. In fact, few places in the world have trees as large as the redwoods. There may be no place in the world that today has trees left the way the protected areas of the redwoods in California are. And to know that a tree that was a seedling 10 years ago, or even this year, has the chance 1,000 years from now to become a giant redwood, it's pretty exciting. But it's just absolutely spellbinding to stand under these trees and look straight up, and their girth is 30, 40 feet around, nothing like it on Earth. I'll be back in just a moment. And when I do, I'm going to talk about labs, not on Labrador retrievers, that is, not only their origin, but sadly the passing of one of the great breeders in America, Mary Howley, who helped lead the world to today's Labrador retrievers. This is Charlie Potter on the Outdoor Voice of Chicago and America, 720 WGN. And first, a message from our longtime sponsors, the Northwest Indiana and Chicagoland Chevrolet dealers.
Hiking, camping, and hunting, it's all an adventure in the great outdoors, but nature can be tough. You need to be ready for anything and everything. Chevy Silverado is built to handle the toughest conditions and get you everywhere you want to go, worry-free. Silverado's designed to handle the big jobs. It's built for the great outdoors. With over 13,000 pounds of towing capacity and trailering sway control, Silverado can haul the biggest loads on the roughest roads and keep you cool as a Sunday drive. With 8 available cameras and up to 14 different views, it can spot trouble before it gets to you. That's peace of mind. And when you're ready for the backcountry, Chevy Silverado 1500 ZR2 owns the off-road. You name it, we run over it. No wonder it's Motor Trend's 2023 four-wheeler pickup truck of the year. So see your Chicagoland and Northwest Indiana Chevy dealer or go to ChevyDriveChicago.com and check out a Chevy Silverado. It's freedom to explore the great outdoors.
It's Charlie Potter and the Great Outdoors on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Welcome back to the Great Outdoors Show. Charlie Potter, your host here on WGN Radio. Mary Howley, a legend, a true legend in the Labrador breeding world, passed away. And I was lucky enough to actually have a Labrador retriever from Mary Howley. She was a Wisconsin breeder, and in 1980, I purchased a Labrador retriever who followed me on the length of my waterfowl migration when I was writing for Field and Stream and Outdoor Life. In 1982, my Labrador retriever, Casey, went all the way to the end of the road in northern Manitoba, north of Flin Flon, and came all the way south with me to the end of the road and beyond in Venice, Louisiana. Mary Howley bred that dog, and it is to this day the one dog we all think about if we are fortunate to have great dogs in our lives. There's always one that stands out. Casey is the one that stood out for me and helped shape my love of labs. Mary Howley became arguably the most famous breeder in all of North America, maybe the world, for Labradors. Her Candlewood Kennel stands at the pinnacle of breeding dogs, and Mary Howley, for 50 years or more, was able to breed champions, and her passing is a sad day in the world of Labradors. She brought along so many breeders after her, so many trainers, and I just had no idea in 1980 when I purchased her dog, a dog from her, Casey, a yellow lab. And by the way, she was known for black labs, and in particular a black lab named Lottie, who was the most famous black lab ever as far as winning awards and medals and being a breeding dog. So let's go from there to maybe for a second the history of labs, because Mary Howley followed on that, and the history of labs almost didn't happen. Labrador Retrievers, the most popular dog in America, most popular breed. It almost didn't happen. And in the remainder of the show today, I'm going to take you down a quick road as to how this actually occurred. How did Labrador Retrievers come to America, but how did they first of all even come into existence? So you have to think about this. Prior to the early 1800s, there was no need for a retrieving dog because we didn't have guns we could shoot birds with. There was no need to go get a bird. You either had falconry was the number one way of sportsmen to pursue birds. Falcons brought you the bird, or nets captured birds. There was no need to retrieve. But as guns came into being and shotguns, you could shoot something here, standing here, and it would drop over there. Well, you needed something to go and find it. So the Labrador actually goes back originally to something called the St. Hubert dog, which kind of looks like a lab, but it really took off by something that became known as the St. John's dog. And these were used in Newfoundland in the 1700s and early 1800s, believe it or not, to catch fish. They needed a dog that would be able, when they had fish on hooks, and the hooks weren't very good, they were bringing them into the shore, they needed a dog that could swim and pick the fish up that came off the hooks. And that's what these Newfoundland dogs did. So there was a breed of dogs developed and bred to do exactly that, to retrieve fish in Newfoundland. And one of the great quotes, I think, in the history of labs is, one of the breeders was asked in Newfoundland, whatever happened? Why did the St. John's retrieving lab, as they called it, cease to exist? He said, we made better fishing hooks. So over time, in the 1700s and early 1800s, a few people from Newfoundland went back to England, and they took their labs with them. And a couple of individuals, it was nobility in England's case, started to breed them. But there were only three known places in all of England where Labrador retrievers were bred. And one of them went out of business when the Earl died. And by happenstance, two other nobility met each other and found out that they both were breeding dogs. And one of them was older, and he gave his six lab females to the breeder who was younger than him. And that actually is the birth of the Labrador Retriever today. And they stayed in England. Nobody in America had a need for a lab. We had Chesapeake Bay Retrievers in America, and they were from the Chesapeake Bay and known for their incredible ability to tolerate really cold water. Think of the Chesapeake Bay and the Eastern Seaboard. But Labrador Retrievers really were not in America. And it was a breed that almost, if these two members of the royal family had not met each other in the mid-1800s to late 1800s and began breeding these dogs, they would have probably gone the way of the passenger pigeon. However, after World War I, when travel became easier and the sporting shoots in England, the driven shoots took place, several Americans went over, and they were the early Americans of empires of which you've heard about, Guggenheim and Field and Harriman and Carnegie and others went over to England to shoot. And they saw these performance of these dogs who sat there and watched you shoot and then retrieve the birds, and they brought them back to America. So there were virtually no Labradors of any kind outside of England until after World War I. And from that, Labradors have become the most popular breed in America. And today, very few are actually used for hunting. Almost all of them are our best friends and household pets. Why? Because they are simply the most sensitive dog to human needs. They're emotional support dogs. They help blind people. They help disabled people. They're bomb-sniffing dogs. They have gone and they're drug-sniffing dogs. Labradors are arguably the smartest of all dogs. They have the best noses, and they have the best disposition. And as we all know who have labs, they're always glad to see you. I've never known a lab to have a bad day, or in fact, really a bad moment. Labradors, dogs are our best friends, and among all dogs, Labradors are probably our best friends for their personality, and that is how, and their hunting acumen, and that is how Labrador breeds went from virtually almost being extinct and no use to coming to America and becoming the most popular breed in America today. Thanks so much for listening. I'll be back next week with much more in the great outdoors. Hope you have a great week in the great outdoors. This is Charlie Potter on the Outdoor Voice of Chicago and America, 720 WGN.